riot!
Her eyes streaming, her nose and throat burning, Christy ran back up the hill. The breeze had blown most of the gas away, not before it had done its damage. All the companions were down in the sand. All of them were blinded. Tears and mucus streamed down their faces and dripped from their chins. They couldn't even open their eyes for the pain. Somewhere in the back of Christy's mind, it registered that the Fire Talker was not among them. She ran from one fallen friend to the next, trying to pull them to their feet and head them downhill.
Come on! We can't stay here! We've got to move!
None of them could get up. Even if they had been able to rise, they couldn't see where to run.
Ryan, please. Please, you've got to.
You go! You could still make it! Go where you can!
No!
As CS gas cleared away downwind, she saw figures popping over the top of the dune. At least a dozen. They were carrying rifles and heading downhill. She had no doubt who they were. Christy held her .38 in a solid two-handed grip and aimed up the hill. She let the murdering bastards get within 30 yards. Then she emptied her weapon into them, center body. Every shot hit its target, but only one of the pirates went down. He fell backward on his butt, but immediately got up again, like it was nothing. Armor, she realized. They had body armor. The Matachin broke into a trot. No time for the speed loader. Christy rolled to her feet and scrambled to reach Ryan's side. She tried to get his Sig Sauer clear of its holster.
Stop, woman!
Christy looked up. The pirate stood in a half circle around her and her incapacitated companions. They held submachine guns in their grubby hands, and machetes were scabbarded at their hips. If enemy guns hadn't been aimed at the others, if it had been just her facing them down, she would have gone for her gun anyway, taken as many headshots as she could get off before they killed her. But under the present circumstances, it was something she couldn't bring herself to do. She didn't want to watch as her friends were murdered. The Matachin closed in and started confiscating the companion's weapons. Christy stared down a gun barrel and surrendered her empty .38 without a struggle. Up close, the pirates had a style and an aroma all their own. The style was like a uniform, down to the hair. Every one of them wore dreadlocks. Some had piled the lengths of felted hair on top of their heads and woven gold chains through them. Their weapons were all of the same design, and it was one she had never seen before. They looked like 9mm, but with very short barrels and top-of-action handles rear sight protectors like M16s, only scaled down in size. Their armor consisted of overlapping plates of black metal or ceramic, which was sewn into vests of what she knew to be Kevlar cloth. The armor covered their chests, backs, crotches, and legs. The pirate with the highest pile of dread seemed well pleased. Understanding began to dawn on Christy as the Matachin lined up in front of her in order of hairdo height, with leers on their filthy faces. It dawned brighter when they unbuckled their crotch armor, then opened the fronts of their trousers. Some of them were already in a state of extreme readiness. Daniel DeCipio stepped out from behind the last pirate in line. He wasn't tear-gassed, and he wasn't in restraints. The Fire Talker stood well back from her and the other companions, poised to duck behind the pirate's considerable bulk if things suddenly got out of hand.
You backstabbing little shit. I wish I'd saved my last bullet for you.
We all do what we have to in order to survive.
You didn't have to do this to us. You wanted to do this to us.
Hardly. Seeing you and your friends brought so low gives me no pleasure at all. And I will get no pleasure from watching what comes to you next. But I have to watch because I've been ordered to do so.
Poor, poor you.
High Pile was at the head of the line. He was the only one who hadn't partially disrobed. He gave up his place in the queue to a much younger, much taller man. Christy fought back a start of shock when she realized the guy with the weird eye was wearing a woman's dress pulled down over his body armor. The shoulder and side seams were all split to hell. The dress had bloodstains. It had evil written all over it. The pirate standing in front of her dropped his machete, scabbard, and belt, then undid his fly. Ryan still couldn't see for his tears, but he didn't move, feeling a gun barrel pressed behind his left ear.
What's going on? What are they doing, Christy?
She wasn't about to tell him, although it was pretty clear what was going to happen to her. If Ryan tried to help, if he went berserk when he found out, he'd get a bullet in his head. Christy rose to her feet. Outnumbered, outgunned, she knew she was probably going to die in the next few minutes, and wished she was dead long before she breathed her last. At least the pirates were coming at her one at a time, in some kind of dreadlock pecking order. That gave her some hope for a little bit of payback. Given the size and strength of the man who was about to attempt to violate her, she wasn't sure she could do the trick unarmed. She had a secret weapon, though, an invisible connection to the power of the Earth. Her mother Sonia had schooled her in the ways of Gaia, the Earth Mother, passing on the ancient knowledge that had been passed on to her. Christy rarely tapped into the energy of that potent spirit, and never without good cause. She needed that special help now, and in silent prayer, with the words her mother had taught her, she begged for Gaia's intercession. The mantra was like flipping a switch, opening a circuit that was always there, always ready. Gaia came to her as a sensation of warmth, then crackling electric energy. It surged into the soles of her feet, up her legs, filled her chest and arms, illuminated the inside of her skull. She felt a confidence and deep calm. Time seemed to slow down as the pirate reached for her left shoulder. Christy didn't look down at his protruding manhood. She stared him straight in the weird eye. Her gaze didn't drop to the target until his filthy fingers actually touched her skin. The designated target wasn't his exposed crotch. It was 5 inches below the point of his dirty chin. When he touched her, it triggered an automatic explosion of movement, precise and lethal. Her right arm shot upward as her legs drove down into the sand. With every ounce of Gaia's strength behind it, she thrust her stiffened fingers into the front of his exposed throat. Her strike hand was as rigid as stone as it plunged into his windpipe. The box of cartilage crunched under her fingertips. She felt it crushed to bits against the front of his spine. One blow. One stunning blow. The pirate slipped to his knees, clutching at his throat with both hands. Confidence gone. There was panic in eyes shot with blood, bulging as if about to pop from their sockets. The pirate's face turned red under the brown, then purple, then black. He slumped to his side and died horribly.
Dolor! Help him!
His fellow pirates rushed over and tried to help, but there was nothing they could do for him. At the end, in his last spasm, he fouled himself so badly, even his pirate friends had to back away. The massive expenditure of force left Christy completely exhausted, as weak as a baby. It was always like that immediately afterward, but this time the strength left her more abruptly than usual. She couldn't repeat the trick without recuperating. She had hoped a demonstration on one of their kind would make the others rethink their plans for amusement. It didn't. They jumped the corpse and gang-rushed her from all sides, easily pulling her down to the sand on her back. She tried to fight them, but was so drained of strength she couldn't push them off. When they had her securely pinned, they began pulling up her shirt and hauling her jeans down around her knees.
Oh, Ubis Roja!
Ucoso!
Christy, what the fuck is going on?
Ryan tried to rise to his feet, only to be pushed down with the gun muzzle. How was she supposed to tell her lover that she was about to be raped to death while he knelt helpless not 30 feet away? Before they could get her boots off and pull her pants off over them to spread her legs, the leader intervened.
Stop!
The pirates backed away from her, shaking their heads in disappointment as they stuffed themselves back in their flies. Christy tugged down her shirt and pulled up her pants. She redid the buttons with difficulty. Her fingers were trembling that hard. She looked to High Pile uncertainly, but he wasn't paying any attention to her.
Chain them. These must go back to the ships.
A gunny sack was tossed onto the sand. The pirates dumped out the contents. Chains and shackles. Before the others could recover, their ankles were cuffed. A short length of chain connected the shackles, making it impossible to run. After similar manacles were clapped on their wrists, chains were connected between wrists and ankles, so the captives couldn't swing a blow. Christy was shackled in exactly the same fashion. And when they were all suitably trussed as individuals, a long length of chain was passed through loops in their ankle cuffs, linking them together. The pirates jerked and kicked them to their feet. Then they were marched back up the dune, back toward the freighter. Ryan, Jack, Mildred, Doc, JB, and Garwood still couldn't see. Tears still streamed down their faces. Their eyelids were almost swollen shut. The new slaves were made to file past High Pile and Daniel DeCipio. As she passed Daniel, Christy turned her head toward him. Harmonica Tom watched as the two fastest pursuit ships continued to close on his stern.
Come on, baby, come on!
He knew he was getting everything there was to get out of Tempest. There was no doubt in his mind that in a fair race between the three, he would come in dead last. If he did nothing, the pirates would bracket him in the open water, bring their grappling hooks to bear, and swing aboard in droves. Desperate times called for desperate measures. Tom cut the helm over to starboard, steering for the mainland shore. He knew the shoals around Padre. He was pretty sure they didn't. Even if they did, it was the only card he had to play. Holding course with his left hand, he opened the backpack of C4. He dumped out a couple of bricks onto the cockpit's bench seat, then picked out a remote detonator. Leaning against the wheel, working on the cabin top in front of it, he ran a power check on the remote, making sure it lit up. Setting it aside, he rigged 4 pounds of high explosive in 2 chunks. He wasn't sure yet how he was going to use the plastique. Maybe he would wait until the pirates got closer and then lob the armed bricks onto the respective decks. Maybe if things really went downhill, if he got boarded, he'd blow up Tempest himself and 2 pirate ships along with it. Gunfire from behind, angling in from both ships, forced him to duck momentarily. When he popped back up, he dead-reckoned a line that ran from the northwest tip of Padre with a dip in the bluff along the mainland shore. Then he checked his compass reading, in case enemy fire made taking a line of sight a dicey proposition at the last minute. If he missed the gap in the shoal, if the sandbar had shifted more than 10 yards in either direction since the last time he was here, it was going to be all over for him in a big hurry. If he made it through, he had a fighting chance. The pursuit continued to gain on him. At the rate they were traveling, they would be side by side with him as he hit the slot.
Unless...
he had one more trick up his sleeve. He was still running with engine as well as sails to squeeze the most speed out of his ship. As the shoal came up fast, Tom pulled the motor into neutral. The pursuit seemed to leap forward. The pirates were so preoccupied with coming alongside that they didn't see the color change in the water rushing up at them, from emerald green to lime green. The ship on the starboard side hit the sandbar at what had to be 15 knots. The keel instantly grounded, the bow pointed up at a 60-degree angle. The vessel stopped so short that the forward momentum cracked off its main mast at the deck.
Yes!
Tom dropped the motor back into gear. The other ship cut speed, veered in behind him, and followed him through the slot. As they shot through the gap, the distance between them was about 20 feet. Another hump of sand was coming up fast. As Tom tried to bring Tempest to port, the ship slowed a little, and the pursuer, keeping a straight course, sped up and joined. For an instant, they were pressed hull to hull.
Shit!
Tom watched in astonishment and fury as the pirates jumped without lines. Booted feet landing hard on his foredeck. Then the pirate ship stopped dead as it too ran aground. Men in the cockpit were thrown up into the sheets, into the booms, thrown overboard. The vessel was stuck good, but it didn't lose its masts. Tom popped his head up over the cabin roof and saw 4 men on his foredeck. They were unslinging submachine guns and taking cover in front of the cabin. A glance over his shoulder told him that the 2 remaining pursuers were following in his wake at a discreet distance. He slipped a loop of line over the wheel to hold course, then drew his gun. Tom rolled out of the port side of the cockpit and came up against the rail in a shooting crouch. One of the pirates angled around the front corner of the cabin, trying to get a bead on him with his submachine gun, but Tom was faster. A hole opened up in the front of the guy's throat as chunks of flesh and blood blew out the back. The pirate flopped under the rail, his head hanging down loose at an unnatural angle, like a broken doll. Then, as the ship hit a line of chop, the body slipped over the side. Tom caught another movement at the corner of the cabin. The pirate ducked back, but not quickly enough. The .45 slug took off half his head, reds and all. Sensing that they were losing their advantage, the remaining 2 pirates rose in unison. They charged the starboard rail, trying to pin him down in the stern. As the ship hit the chop of the gulf, it porpoised and rolled, making it hard for them to keep their balance and stay on target. Tom jumped back in the cockpit and swung the rudder over hard. The main boom swung in the opposite direction, sweeping across the deck and clocking a pirate right in the head, knocking him into the water. The impact left a smear of blood on the sail. The last pirate rushed down the rail while he fired from the hip. He ran out of ammo amidships. Tom popped up from behind the cabin and had him flat-footed, dead in the water. Grinning maniacally, the pirate dropped the empty weapon and reached behind his back. Tom cocked back to Smith's hammer, single action. Tom walked over and looked down at the dead pirate sprawled on his deck.
You dirty bastards chilled a bunch of friends of mine. You chilled them in awful ways.
Looking back toward the stern, he saw that one of the pursuit ships had stopped to pick up the bodies of the two pirates overboard, the throat-shot one and the boom-busted one. Just like off the beach at Padre, the Matachin were recovering their dead. It gave Tom an idea. The other ship kept coming, and it was gaining fast. Wrestling the corpse onto its side, he got the limp arms through the life jacket holes, then rolled the body onto its back. He laid one of the blocks of C4 on the chest, then folded over the front panels and cinched the binding straps up extra tight. Tom grabbed up the last dead pirate and stuffed him into another life jacket. This time he stuffed the brick of C4 into the back of it. Then he bore down hard on the binding tapes. He tipped them over the side, one after the other. Tempest sailed on, leaving two men in life jackets bobbing in its wake. The skipper took out his harmonica. Sure enough, the ship closing in on him dropped sail and slowed to pick up the dead. The fourth ship was coming up on it from behind, trying to re-engage the pursuit. When the lead ship stopped alongside the floating men, Tom put down his harmonica, aimed the detonator, and pointing it over the stern, hit the little red button. A waterspout shot into the sky. Along with it went half the ship's port side.
Woo-wee!
Stuff blown skyward rained down all around the stricken craft, splashing in a wide circle. All of a sudden, there were a lot more corpses and parts thereof for the pirates to recover. As water flooded into the breached side of hull, the ship immediately began to tilt in that direction, the masts angling lower and lower until they touched the water. The fourth and last ship approached the wreck cautiously, just in case there were more explosives. With the pressure off, Tom indulged himself. He danced an ungainly jig, accompanied by himself on the harmonica. The moment of triumph passed, and the skipper of Tempest was left with lingering doubts. Serious doubts. Was what he had just done enough? Did it balance the books? After all, the pirates had murdered a couple hundred people. They had brought down one of the Hellscape's living legends, Ryan Cotter. On its face, it hardly seemed like tit for tat. He still had a shitload of C4 that could be put to use. What good was Jack when it had the blood of so many good people on it? It was something he would have to contemplate. Tom cut his engine and let the wind take his ship southwest. Then scooped a bucket of seawater to sluice the residue of brains and skull off his foredeck. On the beach below the Yokomaru, the new slaves awaited their master's pleasure. Ryan could see again, as could his companions and the islander boy Garwood. Ryan's eyes still burned, still teared a little, but he could see, and he was aware of the totality of their predicament. They were disarmed, chained, and held at gunpoint. Ryan knew nothing about the pirates, except for their brutality, and they were packed with some impressive weaponry. They had slaughtered an entire vill for what? Not for its material wealth. Most of that had burned in the shantytown, but was still burning in the grounded freighter. They had made no attempt to put out the fires, or to secure the goods that hadn't been destroyed. They didn't seem to give a damn about any of it. About any of the things that the people of the Hellscape would have gladly killed for. It was something that really worried Ryan. As long as their motives were unknown, their future actions couldn't be anticipated. He was furious at himself for letting Daniel live. He should have killed them when they first boarded the freighter. Standing behind the pirate with the tallest pile of dreads, Daniel looked like a pet that was barely tolerated, a creature used to receiving the back of a hand on a whim. Cowed, cringing, servile. That's one reason Ryan figured that he was harmless. Despicable, but harmless. The nature of the servitude was as unclear as everything else. What had he been doing on the island? Scouting it out for the attack? That didn't seem likely. There was no way for him to pass information he had gathered to the pirates. Not without leaving the place. It was too isolated. And if he had left Padre Island to deliver his scouting report, why had he come back? There would have been no reason to do that. Ryan glanced to his side and saw Christy glaring at Daniel too.
We almost made it. If it hadn't been for that smarmy little bastard, we would have. We were that close.
At least Tom got away.
He turned his back on us. He ran off with his ship and left us for dead.
He didn't owe us anything. There was nothing he could do. And he had the right to save himself.
Would we have left him like that?
If the situation was reversed, I'd say yes. In a heartbeat.
Christy looked down. She didn't like that answer, but she knew it to be true. A quartet of pirates marched down the slope from the freighter, solemnly carrying the body of the man she had killed, evidently some kind of officer. They bore the corpse back to the beach, where a funeral pyre had been constructed. The bodies of the Matachin fallen were laid out in a pyramid, on top of stacks of unburned wood scavenged from the vill. With great care, they set the corpse among the others. The explosion came from the southwest. The companions couldn't see what it was, but they recognized the sound. There were smiles all around. Even JB managed one.
I guess old Tom found some use for that C4.
The armorer was in a bad way. His face was twisted in pain, and it looked pale and drawn. The CS gas hadn't helped his breathing, and the paroxysms of vomiting hadn't helped his ribs.
Our intrepid captain. I wish him godspeed.
Hope he kicked their asses good.
Hey, you! Maybe you'd better wait before you light that pyre. From that sound, it's my guess that there's some more of you bastards in need of ceremonial burning.
Silencio, esclavos!
Esclavos? Does that last bit mean what I think it does?
Unpaid labor unto death, I'm afraid. We have joined the ranks of the terminally employed.
Along with the handful of other survivors from the freighter, the companions and Garwood were forced to climb into the rafts. All the new slaves were handed oars, and with guns trained on them, they rowed themselves to the waiting tugs. The Matachin commander rowed in the bow of the companion's dinghy, making notes in pencil in a crumpled little book. Daniel sat at his feet. Two of his underlings guarded the rowers with leveled submachine guns. The tug's engines were silent. As they approached the vessels, long oars in a row dipped lightly into the water, holding position. In the skinny shadow of the awnings, gaunt, sunburned faces stared back at them. Hopeless faces. As Mildred leaned into her oar, she glanced at her friends.
I'm getting a premonition of what our job is going to be.
When they came alongside the pirate flagship, after the commander and Daniel had debarked, they were forced to board in a clinking, clanking, clumsy conga line. Then they were herded together on the stern deck. Ryan looked closely at the people sitting under the awning. Shirtless men and boys, a few women, also shirtless. Their manacles were chained to the oars so they couldn't let go. There were lash marks on their bare backs and arms. Some looked to be at death's door, living skeletons with blistered, peeling skin. They were breathing hard, though they weren't exerting themselves. Their whip wounds were inflamed and leaking green pus. When the pirates disconnected the newcomers, pulling the length of chain out of the loops of their ankle cuffs, Garwood sprang away like a tiger. In three great hops, he was behind Daniel and had flipped his manacles over his head and down over his neck. Crossing the cuffs behind the startled man's head, the boy twisted his arms, tightening the chain-link garrote. Daniel's eyes bulged and his tongue protruded. He tried to shift out of the chokehold, but the teenager wouldn't allow it. Before the boy could break his neck or strangle him, one of the pirates drew his machete and whacked him with the flat of it on top of the head. The stunning blow drove the boy to his knees, taking Daniel down with him. The fire talker disengaged himself from the chain and moved well out of range. Machi raised the heavy blade, winding up to use its long edge to take off Garwood's head at the shoulders. Before he struck the fatal blow, he looked over at his leader. The commander waved him off impatiently.
No, don't kill him. We need him on the oars.
I'll get you, you shit fire talker. I'll get you yet. You wait and see.
The fire talker rubbed his throat. The chain links had left angry welts from ear to ear.
I am afraid that's not likely.
Daniel looked from the livid boy to a pirate bent over the stern deck. Daniel's expression fell as the man opened an inset hatch about 4 feet by 4 feet. A pair of pirates swooped in and grabbed hold of Daniel under the arms. They carried him bodily to the opening and threw him in feet first.
No!
The hatch slammed shut. One of the pirates twisted shut the latch, locking him inside.
So, the turncoat is a prisoner too.
That's strange. It's not like he could swim and get away.
I don't like the look of that.
Ryan nodded toward the awnings. The Matachin were unchaining some of the slaves from the oars and making them shuffle to the stern. The weakest ones. Those who could barely stand were separated from the rest. They were so exhausted they couldn't resist. One by one, they were bent over the stern rail and dispatched with single machete blows across the backs of their necks. Their bodies were dumped over the side. It was a horrible spectacle. Barbaric. Those who had been spared beheading stood huddled in a corner of the stern while the commander took stock of the new arrivals. He felt their muscles, poked their ribs, examined their backs. When he touched JB, the armorer grimaced in pain. It was clear he was not in top shape. At the commander's order, one of the pirates pulled up the hem of JB's shirt, exposing the multicolored bruising over his ribs. He waved JB to one side, the side with the other weaklings.
Are they going to chill JB?
The pirates quickly moved the fresh slaves forward, forcing them to take the newly emptied places behind the oars. The rowers sat three across on crude wooden platforms, all pulling on the same shaft. The seats were unpadded, there were no backrests to lean against. Ryan watched in silent fury as both his manacles were chained to the oar. Mildred sat on his right, closest to the gunwale. Ryan laid his hands on the highly polished shaft, polished by human skin. The commander climbed the stairs to the pilot house deck.
Row!
A pirate on the stern deck started pounding a steel drum with rag-wrapped hammers, setting the stroke rhythm. It was difficult to get the timing at first. Everyone on the oar had to pull together, and all the oars on that side of the tug had to pull together as well. As Ryan was struggling to make it all work, a lash struck him across the shoulders. He turned and glared up at the man who had just struck him. He smelled like a bear pit. The pirate coiled his short braided whip for another blow. He clearly enjoyed this part of his work. Once they had acquired some momentum, the rowing was a little easier. Ryan and Mildred fell into the rhythm of it. The tugboats headed south, away from the island, what had to be a prearranged rendezvous point. Three of the pursuit sailboats were waiting for them offshore. Two of the pirate vessels were damaged, one badly, and one of the ships was missing.
Tom did good.
Under threat of the lash, the slaves leaned on their oars, once again working up momentum. Facing the rear, Ryan had a view of the still-burning freighter. He also saw some of the pirates lounging at the stern rail. They were smiling, despite their commander's rage. Trinkets were on display. Gold trinkets. It looked like they were making bets. Then they started dividing the weaklings into pairs and standing them side by side. Short and tall, skinny and skinnier, old and young, male and female. Ryan watched as JB was forced to stand next to a much bigger man, older, with a mat of gray hair on his chest. All the body fat had been worked off him. His face was haggard and grim. From the pilot house deck, the commander surveyed the action.
Whoever wins, lives.
Daniel had been hoping for a few more hours, even a day or two of freedom above deck. There was no reason for him to be thrown into the one-person-sized hold so soon. They were offshore, and would remain offshore for the entire voyage back home. Casacampo didn't question orders. He followed them to the letter. By order of the Lords of Death and Atapul the Tenth, Enanos were to be kept in solitary confinement en route to their missions, and after their missions were completed. It was supposed to be a safeguard, to keep the plague from spreading to the crew and slaves, and to other unintended targets. The dengue weapon had no antidote. It burned through lives like wildfire. If it wasn't used with great caution, it could destroy everything the Lords had built. But what stuck in Daniel's craw was that everyone knew that mosquitoes didn't fly miles out to sea. The cell had a vent at the back, near the ceiling, about 6 inches high by a foot long. It was covered with a fine mesh screen to keep mosquitoes out. The vent let in a little light and a little fresh air. If he pressed his cheek against the inside of the hatch and twisted his head just right, he could look out at the boat wake. He didn't feel much like twisting his head at that moment. His neck still ached, and he could almost feel the chain the Islander boy had tried to choke him with. The narrow chamber was furnished with a fiber mat on the floor for sleeping, a plastic water jug, and a covered bucket for excrement and urine. Cozy was not the word for it. Daniel shuddered to think how much of his life since his resurrection had been spent in a foul, stifling cage just like this. They only let him out to spread the plague, and there was no telling when that would happen again. Daniel slumped to the mat and hung his head in his hands. He knew what the redhead thought of him, what Eyepatch and the others thought of him. But he didn't consider himself evil at heart. The Monachine, now they were evil. They had a choice in their behavior. They were volunteers in the service of the Lords. They signed on to commit excesses in the name of a greater authority. The Lords, they were even more evil. As in the Mayan myths, they commanded human suffering, sickness, and death on a colossal scale. And they reveled in their power, always seeking to expand their territory. If anything, Daniel considered himself a victim of circumstance and his own naivete. Was there ever a reward for his diligent service? Or just a pat on the head and a good job, Daniel? Nope, there never was. And there never would be. In a self-pitying mood, he fell back on a familiar replay. How had it all come down to this? He recalled the day of his arrival on Devil's Island in a kaleidoscope of image and sensation. The heat, the jungle, the screaming of the howler monkeys, crocs, wild dogs, snakes, the overgrown concrete prison, moldy outside, inside spotless. He flashed back to a spartanly furnished white-painted cell, to the experiments, all very clinical, sterile, injections of serum by little brown nurses in starched white uniforms. In the preliminary interviews back in the States, no one had said anything about mosquitoes or bioweapons. They hadn't mentioned it was a military research program. He'd gotten sick the first week. All the test subjects had gotten sick. He was one of the few who recovered, and the recovery had taken months. Only then did the scientists of Project Persephone tell him what they'd done to him, after it was too late. They told him they had created a weapon they couldn't control. The entire genetic engineering bag of tricks had no effect on the carriers. What had been done to their blood could not be undone. By way of an apology, the scientists had offered the cryogenesis option. Daniel remembered the thawing, his waking up in a stainless steel coffin. He remembered his first agonizing, lung-ripping inhalation. When he came out of cryostasis, still on the island, he learned that the offspring of the prisoners had renamed that awful place Xibalba, the Mayan word for hell. Once again alone in the narrow dark with his recycling thoughts, alone for God knew how long, Daniel DeCipio's tears fell. Ryan pulled back on the oar, studying the pirates as they moved the five pairs of combatants around, setting the order of the upcoming fights to the death. When the order was finalized, it appeared that JB's match was scheduled for last. At the end of the line of fighters, the armorer leaned against the stern rail, arms folded over his ribcage. Mildred was beside herself as she tried to row and keep an eye on him.
JB can't fight. Not with those ribs. Look how big the other guy is.
Maybe he can protect and hide the injury.
The other guy saw his chest. He saw JB's ribs when the Dreadmaster lifted up his shirt. He knows where the bullseye is.
JB will think of something. He always does.
Ryan hoped he was right. He couldn't help his oldest friend fight for his life, and he couldn't slip him a weapon that would tip the odds in his favor. All he could do was watch. As the coxswain pounded out the tempo for the rowers, the pirates unmanacled the first two fighters and shoved them together in the middle of the stern deck. The two scrawny men were evenly matched in size and reserves of strength. They both knew exactly what was at stake. They threw themselves at each other like wildcats. The strategy was obvious. They were trying to seize the advantage before their energy gave out. Punches, kicks, claw hands came in frantic flurries as the men stood toe to toe. There was no defense, just offense. The pirates ringing the stern rails cheered for whichever man they had bet on. Blood drops spattered the deck as the two barefoot fighters clenched and grappled. It didn't take long for them to begin to wear down. After 2 minutes, the punch fest became a hug fest as they hung on to each other for support, trying to regather their strength. Their body blows lost power and came in single punches instead of combinations, and at less frequent intervals. Neither could gain advantage. It looked like the stalemate was going to continue, a round and round, slow shuffle dance, when one of the men suddenly collapsed to his knees. He was unable to get up, unable to stop the other guy from swinging around behind him, wrapping both hands around his neck and squeezing. The kneeling man was too weak to fend him off. He couldn't pry the fingers off his throat. It was just a matter of time. The squeezer kept up the pressure until his opponent went limp. Then he let the body drop to the deck. The other guy wasn't dead. Ryan could see him breathing. He was just choked out and unconscious. The victor stood over the prostrate loser, hands on hips. One of the pirates handed him a machete. It had a wicked gut hook at its tip, and the main edge looked razor sharp.
Good grief!
What happened next wasn't clean, and it wasn't pretty. It was a hack job, start to finish. Death, when it came to the fallen and unconscious man, came as a result of 40 shallow chops instead of one. A rain of blows sprayed blood in a wide fan across the deck and over the stern gunwale. When the deed was done, the machete was taken away from the man. As he was dragged to an empty place under the awning and chained to an oar, winning and losing bets were paid off. No one bothered to wash off the deck before the next set of fighters was thrown together, a skinny man and a large woman, both naked to the waist and streaked with sweat and dirt.
I can't watch this.
Mildred turned her head away, looking out at the gulf, as she continued to row in time to the drumbeat. Ryan wouldn't permit himself to look away from the spectacle. He was hoping to find some kind of strategy that would work for JB, some plan, some trick he could yell out to him. There was a lot of punching and kicking between the mixed sex fighters. At one point, the man had the upper hand. But he couldn't close the deal. The woman, who outweighed him by 40 pounds, shot a snap kick to his solar plexus. It made her heavy breasts fly almost up to her chin. The hard kick dropped the guy like a sack of rocks. The woman did a better job with the machete. Five strokes instead of 40. As the pirates dumped the man's corpse over the side, Mildred turned back to Ryan.
They're killing each other so they can take a few more breaths of air, so their hearts can beat another 1,000 times. Look at them. They're all goners.
Based on that assessment, JB was a goner too, but Ryan chose not to point that out. Even if JB survived the coming fight, afterward he was going to have to pick up an oar and row, something that his broken ribs would make very difficult. If he couldn't row, he was going to be flogged. A lot. Which would make it even harder to row. There wasn't much wiggle room in the situation. Two grizzled old men were pushed into the makeshift ring next. Both looked to be on their last legs. They were starved to skeletons. Their skin was peeling off in big white patches, revealing bright pink flesh beneath. Neither one hit the eye of the tiger. After some slow circling and a few soft overhand blows, one of the men clutched the center of his chest and dropped to the deck.
For Nuke's sake, look!
Coronary, probably.
The white-haired Victor didn't have the strength to swing the machete. He tried several times, but he could only deal out superficial, shallow cuts. Finally, a burly pirate seized back the machete. With a single downward chop, he split open the stricken man's skull from crown to the bridge of his nose. He then put his boot on the man's neck and levered the blade back and forth to free it. The lucky winner barely made it to the port rail without falling himself. The pirates didn't like the performance. The killing hadn't been done by the winner. Then the commander walked to the railing.
The winner is too weak to be of use. Eliminate him.
In short order, the victor received the same treatment as the loser. A machete blade to the skull from behind. Then both of the bodies were pitched overboard. They bobbed together in the tug's wake. So far, Ryan hadn't picked up anything JB could use. Each contest had been defined by the physical limits of the opponents. The fourth match was only slightly more exciting than the third. The two men were decades younger, with deeper natural reserves of strength and more powerful wills to survive. They had, however, been galley slaves for a while, long enough to be used up and thrown away. They both managed to draw blood from punches to their mouths and noses before their arms hung down limp and useless by their sides. Suddenly, one of the pirates slid his machete along the decking toward the combatants. The blade stopped at their feet. Both men dropped down on their hands and knees and began struggling for control of the weapon. Somehow, in the subsequent pulling back and forth and the rolling around on the deck, one man ended up flat on his back and the other on top, straddling him. They each had hold of the big knife's handle. The man on top was trying to bring the long edge across the front of his opponent's throat. The man on the bottom was trying to drive the gut hook into his counterpart's neck. It was another stalemate, but not for long. Gradually, using the dead weight of his body more than main strength, the man on top wore down the other guy's strength. The blade came closer and closer, and then it bit into his unprotected throat. The man on top pressed down harder, making blood well up around the edge of the blade. Then, with a savage flourish, top man whipped the machete crosswise, cutting the man's neck wide open. Blood gushed out onto the deck. In a few seconds, it was over. The loser went over the side. Bets were paid off. It was JB's turn next.
Mildred, you've got to watch this. We might be his only chance. We might be able to help him.
Help him? He can't punch. He can't breathe deeply, so he won't have any stamina. And the other guy is 8 inches taller. Ryan, I'll watch, but all we can do for him is pray.
The last pair of fighters was shoved together on the stern. JB looked extra small compared to the guy he was pitted against.
He left his glasses and hat on. Maybe he knows something we don't.
Ryan figured that JB wanted to die wearing his hat and glasses. The other guy had much longer arms. JB kept moving, circling around and around, avoiding the lunges, looking for a way under the man's guard. JB feinted left, and when the man reached out, he booted him in the right kneecap. It slowed the guy down, big time. Sensing he'd lost something important, the next time JB's opponent lunged, he really extended himself. He managed to catch the armorer by the collar, not the neck as he'd probably intended. Before JB could twist out of his grasp, the bigger man body punched him. For a second, all the blood drained out of JB's face.
Oh no, no.
JB brought the edge of his boot heel down on the tips of the man's bare toes. The guy let go, and JB moved to the right, favoring his injured side. Then Ryan noticed something about the way the other guy moved. His back was rigid, stiff, like it was locked in place. He didn't twist his torso as he lunged for JB. He lunged straight ahead. His only plan of attack was to get hold of his adversary and not let go. If the guy couldn't turn at the waist, he couldn't defend himself from a side attack. And if he couldn't do that, he was in deep shit.
JB! Flank!
JB didn't look over to acknowledge that he had heard and understood. He didn't take his eyes off his opponent, but he immediately reversed course, then reversed again. Ryan smiled for the first time in what seemed like hours.
Why are you grinning? What is there to grin at?
JB's checking the guy's range of motion, seeing which side is the least flexible.
And how is that?
JB showed her how. He faked the big guy into moving toward his stronger side. Then, before his opponent could pivot back, JB stepped forward. And heel kicked him behind the same kneecap he'd kicked before. The leg gave way under the man, and he crashed to his back on the deck. Holding his ribs with the insides of his forearms, JB didn't waste the advantage. He laid into the guy with a series of snap kicks to the ribs and the side of his head. JB didn't kick in the guy's head with his steel-toed boots, maybe because he didn't want to, maybe because he was winded and didn't have the strength. As he moved back, his opponent rolled onto his stomach, then pushed up on his hands and knees. His head hung down. Blood dripped in a steady stream from his face, splattering on the deck in front of him. It was game over. But there was one more thing that had to be done. One more awful thing. One of the pirates handed JB a machete. He accepted the weapon. The expression that passed over his face was disgust. If he didn't chop the guy, I knew the chances were good he'd get chopped himself, like the geezer who couldn't make the kill. JB stepped within striking range of his opponent's exposed neck. The man looked up at him with horror and desperation. He didn't want to die like a chicken. He wanted to die like a man. JB gave him a little nod, an almost imperceptible nod toward the stern rail. Ryan caught it, but no one else did. The armorer raised the machete skyward, then paused as if to summon his strength. The hesitation was on purpose. It gave the doomed man the chance to scramble to his feet. And dive head first over the side. The pirates rushed to the stern, hauling out and shouldering their submachine guns, looking for a head to shoot at. But the loser never surfaced. Not so much as a trail of bubbles. They were miles offshore. Dead was dead, after all. Evidently, the climax satisfied the Matachin. Bets were paid off without complaint. JB had clearly won the contest. A pirate snatched the machete from him, then escorted him at gunpoint to the awning. JB was chained to the same oar as Mildred and Ryan, on the inside empty seat.
Nice fight. Never a doubt, huh?
That guy messed me up. I'm not gonna be much good pulling on an oar for a while.
Don't worry about it.
We'll pick up the slack for you. You can just coast until you feel better.
I wonder where we are going.
A slave on the oar ahead of Mildred glanced furtively back at her. He was sweating and pale, but kept rowing.
We're going south. To Veracruz.
Down in Mex?
Uh-huh. How far is it?
One hell of a long way to row.
Harmonica Tom sat some 75 feet above the deck of Tempest. He was perched in a bosun's chair he'd hauled up near the top of the main mast. For some, the high suspended seat under full sail and on choppy seas would have been petrifying, but he was more than used to it. He enjoyed the expanded view and the exaggerated roll of the ship that the vantage point offered. Through his binocs, he was watching the Matachin fleet at an extreme distance, paralleling their course to keep them in sight. Two of the sailboats were limping along. They hadn't fared so well in the contest of skippers. The third was on the bottom of the gulf by now. A smile lifted Tom's handlebar mustache. He could see the light reflected off the tug's oar blades. They all flashed at once as the paddles turned and dipped in rhythm. Some of the folks chained to those oars were islanders. It was a safe bet. All of them were Deathlanders. He had no way of telling whether Ryan Cawder or any of his crew were captives. He hoped they weren't dead, but he wouldn't wish the fate of a galley slave on them either. It could have been him pulling on one of those oars, he knew, but for dumb luck and a hard following wind. Looking through the binocs, he had to wonder if he had been saved for some greater purpose. Him and all that C4. He would have attacked the pirate ships then and there, run amok among them with his machine gun and explosives. If he could have, he would have killed all the Matachine, freed the slaves, and scuttled their evil boats. A man alone, even a man with a shitload of C4, a man who was no stranger to excessive violence, had to be cautious when the odds were way long against him. He had to think hard on his strategy and pick his time and place to strike. The skipper of Tempest, swaying high over its deck, flying under full sail, stared at the row of little boats bouncing in and out of his Binox field of view.
You bastards don't know it yet, but Harmonica Tom is about to go legendary on your asses.
Deathlands Plague Lords is a graphic audio production. Deathlands and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2008, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Richard Rowan, Terrence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King-Williams, Thomas Penny, Michael John Casey, Mort Shelby, David Coyne, Andy Clements, Jeff Baker, Elizabeth Demery, Ken Jackson, and Casey Platt. Additional Richards performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Ken Jackson. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Temeskin Wubna. Adapted for graphic audio by Cheryl Hayes. The Deathlands theme was composed by Mark Ashby. Additional original music by Temeskin Wubna. If you enjoyed Deathlands, be sure to look for James Axler's Outlanders and Earthblood. Available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for a preview of another graphic audio title.
Elantris was beautiful once. It was called the City of the Gods, a place of power, radiance, and magic. As magnificent as Elantris was, its inhabitants were more so. Their hair, a brilliant white, their skin, an almost metallic silver. The Elantrians seemed to shine like the very city itself. They were divinities. Elantris, the home of the gods, where one could live in bliss, rule in wisdom, and be worshipped for an eternity. Eternity ended 10 years ago.
Go to the heathen peoples of the West. Declare to them my final warning.
Care nothing for the squabbles between the two sects, priest. Go convert someone who doesn't believe.
You should not dismiss the offering of worms so casually.
Honestly, priest, do we need to go through this? Your threats hold no weight. Fjordan hasn't held any real influence for 2 centuries.
Fjordan is more powerful now than it ever was before. The Day of Empire is at hand, and my glory will soon shine forth.
No, it cannot be! Prince Raoden is stricken with the Sheol!
The pagan nations of Aerilon and Teod have been blackened scars upon my land for long enough.
Elantris.
That Fjordel Gion is interested in Elantris for some reason. And I make it my business never to ignore what a Gion finds interesting.
You seem to be rather preoccupied with a single priest, Edie.
Not a priest, Uncle. A full Gion.
Still only one man. How much damage can he do?
Ask the Duladan Republic. I think this is the same Gion who was involved in that disaster.
The holy soldiers of Fjordan will descend on the nation like hunting predators, rending and tearing the unworthy life from those who heed not my words. Convert or fall forever. There are no other choices.
Every pain soon. Every cut. Every nick. Every bruise. And every ache. They will stay with you until you go mad from the suffering. Welcome to Elantris.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.